Side 12. The Autobiography of Malcolm X. Continuing on page 409. Elijah Muhammad at his headquarters in Chicago grew emotionally affected whenever the name of Malcolm X had to be raised in his presence, one of the Muslims in Clay's entourage told me. Mr. Muhammad reportedly had said, "Brother Malcolm got to be a big man. I made him big. I was about to make him a great man." The faithful black Muslims predicted that soon Malcolm X would be turned upon by the defectors from Mosque No. 7 who had joined him. "They will feel betrayed," said others. "A great chastisement of Allah will fall upon a hypocrite." Mr. Muhammad reportedly had said at another time, "Malcolm is destroying himself," and that he had no wish whatever to see Malcolm X die, that he would rather see him live and suffer his treachery. The general feeling among Harlemites, non-Muslims, with whom I talked, was that Malcolm X had been powerful and influential enough a minister that eventually he would split the mosque membership into two hostile camps, and that in New York City, at least, Elijah Muhammad's unquestioned rule would be ended. Malcolm X returned. He said that he had been in Boston and Philadelphia. He spent ample time with me, now during the day, in room 1936 in the Hotel Americana. His old total ease was no longer with him. As if it was the most natural thing in the world to do, at sudden intervals he would stride to the door, pulling it open, he would look up and down the corridor, then shut the door again. "If I am alive when this book comes out, it will be a miracle," he said by way of explanation. "I'm not saying it distressingly." He leaned forward and touched the buff gold bedspread. "I'm saying it like I say, that's a bedspread." For the first time, he talked with me in some detail about what had happened. He said that his statement about President Kennedy's assassination was not why he'd been ousted from the Muslims. "It wasn't the reason at all. Nobody said anything when I made stronger statements before. The real reason," he said, "was jealousy in Chicago. And I had objected to the immorality of the man who professed to be more moral than anybody." Malcolm X said that he had increased the Nation of Islam membership from about 400 when he had joined to around 40,000. "I don't think there were more than 400 in the country when I joined. I really don't. They were mostly older people, and many of them couldn't even pronounce Mr. Muhammad's name, and he stayed mostly in the background." Malcolm X worked hard not to show it, but he was upset. "There is nothing more frightful than ignorance in action. Goethe," he scribbled one day. He hinted about Cassius Clay a couple of times, and when I responded only with anecdotes about my interview with Clay, he finally asked what Clay had said of him. I dug out the index card on which the question was typed in advance, and Clay's response was beneath in longhand. Malcolm X stared at the card, then out of the window, and he got up and walked around. One of the few times I ever heard his voice betray his hurt was when he said, "I felt like a blood big brother to him." He paused. "I'm not against him now. He's a fine young man, smart. He's just let himself be used, led astray." And at another time, there in the hotel room, he came the nearest to tears that I ever saw him, and also the only time I ever heard him use, for his race, one word. He'd been talking about how hard he'd worked building up the Muslim organization in the early days when he was first moved to New York City, when abruptly he exclaimed hoarsely, "We had the best organization the black man's ever had. Niggers ruined it." A few days later, however, he wrote in one of his memo books this, which he let me read. "Children have a lesson adults should learn. To not be ashamed of failing, but to get up and try again. Most of us adults are so afraid, so cautious, so safe, and therefore so shrinking and rigid and afraid. That is why so many humans fail. Most middle-aged adults have resigned themselves to failure." Telephone calls came frequently for Malcolm X when he was in the room with me, or he would make calls. He would talk in a covert, guarded manner, clearly not wishing me to be able to follow the discussion. I took to going into the bathroom at these times and closing the door, emerging when the murmuring of his voice had stopped, hoping that made him more comfortable. Later he would tell me that he was hearing from some Muslims who were still ostensibly Elijah Muhammad's followers. "I'm a marked man," he said one day after such a call. I've had highly placed people tell me to be very careful every move I make. He thought about it. Just as long as my family doesn't get hurt, I'm not frightened for myself. I have the impression that Malcolm X heard in advance that the Muslim organization was going to sue to make him vacate the home he and his family lived in. I'd become worried that Malcolm X, bitter, would want to go back through the chapters in which he had told of his black Muslim days and re-edit them in some way. The day before I left New York City to return upstate, I raised my concern to Malcolm X. "I have thought about that," he said. "There are a lot of things I could say that passed through my mind at times even then, things I saw and heard, but I threw them out of my mind. I'm going to let it stand the way I've told it. I want the book to be the way it was." Then, March 26, 1964, a note came from Malcolm X. "There is a chance that I may make a quick trip to several very important countries in Africa, including a pilgrimage to the Muslim holy cities of Mecca and Medina, beginning about April 13th. Keep this to yourself." While abroad, Malcolm X wrote letters and postcards to almost everyone he knew well. His letters now were signed El Haj Malik El Shabazz. Then, in mid-May, Sister Betty telephoned me, her voice jubilant. Malcolm X was returning. I flew to New York City. On May 21st, the phone rang in my hotel room, and Sister Betty said, "Just a minute, please." Then the deep voice said, "How are you?" "Well, El Haj Malik El Shabazz, how are you?" he said, "just a little bit tired." He'd arrived on a Pan American Airlines flight at 4:30. He was going to have a press conference at 7 p.m. at the Hotel Teresa. "I'll pick you up at 6:30 at 135th and Lenox on the uptown side, all right?" When the blue Oldsmobile stopped and I got in, El Haj Malcolm, broadly beaming, wore a seersucker suit. The red hair needed a barber's attention, and he'd grown a beard. Also in the car was Sister Betty. It was the first time we'd ever seen each other after more than a year of talking several times a week on the telephone. We smiled at each other. She wore dark glasses, a blue maternity suit, and she was pregnant with what would be her fourth child. There must have been 50 still and television photographers and reporters jockeying for position up front, and the rest of the Skyline ballroom was filling with Negro followers of Malcolm X or his well-wishers and the curious. The room lit up with flickering and flooding lights as he came in the door, squiring Sister Betty, holding her arm tenderly, and she was smiling broadly in her pride that this man was her man. I recognized the Times' M.S. Handler and introduced myself. We warmly shook hands and commandeered a little two-chair table. The reporters in a thick semicircle before Malcolm X, seated on the podium, fired questions at him, and he gave the impression that all of his 12 years' oratorical practice had prepared him for this new image. "Do we correctly understand that you now do not think all whites are evil?" "True, sir. My trip to Mecca has opened my eyes. I no longer subscribe to racism. I've adjusted my thinking to the point where I believe that whites are human beings." A significant pause. "As long as this is borne out by their humane attitude toward Negroes." They picked at his racist image. "I am not a racist. I'm not condemning whites for being whites, but for their deeds. I condemn what whites collectively have done to our people collectively." He almost continually flashed about the room the ingratiating, boyish smile. He would pick at the new reddish beard. They asked him about that. Did he plan to keep it? He said he hadn't decided yet. He would have to see if he could get used to it or not. Was he maneuvering to now join the major civil rights leaders whom he'd previously bitterly attacked? He answered that one sideways. "I'll explain it this way, sir. If some men are in a car, driving with a destination in mind, and you know they're going the wrong way, but they're convinced they're going the right way, then you get into the car with them and ride with them, talking. And finally, when they see they're on the wrong road, not getting where they were intending, then you tell them, and they will listen to you then, what road to take." He'd never been in better form, weighing, parrying, answering the questions. The Times Handler beside me was taking notes and muttering under his breath, "Incredible, incredible." I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking, some of the time, that if a pebble were dropped from the window behind Malcolm X, it would have struck on a sidewalk 8 floors below where years before he had skulked selling dope. As I resumed riding upstate, periodic notes came from Malcolm X. I hope the book is proceeding rapidly, for events concerning my life happen so swiftly, much of what has already been written can easily be outdated from month to month. In life, nothing is permanent, not even life itself. Smile. So I would advise you to rush it on out as fast as possible. Another note, special delivery, had a tone of irritation with me. He had received from the publisher a letter which indicated that he'd received a $2,500 check when the book contract was signed, and therefore I will be expected to pay personal income tax on this. As you know, it was my repeated specification that this entire transaction was to be made at that time directly with and to the mosque. In fact, I have never seen that check to this very day. The matter was straightened out, and I sent Malcolm X some rough chapters to read. I was appalled when they were soon returned, red inked in many places where he had told of his almost father and son relationship with Elijah Muhammad. Telephoning Malcolm X, I reminded him of his previous decision, and I stressed that if those chapters contained such telegraphing to readers of what would lie ahead, then the book would automatically be robbed of some of its building suspense and drama. Malcolm X said gruffly, "Whose book is this?" I told him, "Yours, of course," and that I only made the objection in my position as a writer. He said that he would have to think about it. I was heartsick at the prospect that he might want to re-edit the entire book into a polemic against Elijah Muhammad. But late that night, Malcolm X telephoned. "I'm sorry. You're right. I was upset about something. Forget what I wanted changed. Let what you already had stand." I never again gave him chapters to review unless I was with him. Several times I would covertly watch him frown and wince as he read, but he never again asked for any change in what he'd originally said. And the only thing that he ever indicated that he wished had been different in his life came when he was reading the chapter, Laura. He said, "That was a smart girl. A good girl. She tried her best to make something out of me, and look what I started her into. Dope and prostitution. I wrecked that girl." Malcolm X was busy, busy, busy. He could not visit my hotel room often, and when he did, it shortly would get the feeling of Grand Central Station. It seemed that when the telephone was not ringing for him, he was calling someone else, consulting the jotted numbers in his ever-ready memorandum book. Now he began to talk a great deal with various people from the Middle East or Africa who were in New York. Some of these came to see him at the hotel room. At first, I would sit by the window, engrossed in reading, while they talked by the room's door in low tones. He was very apologetic when this occurred, and I told him I felt no sensitivity about it. Then afterwards, I would generally step out into the hallway, or perhaps take the elevator down to the lobby, then watch the elevators until I saw the visitor leave. One day, I remember, the phone had rung steadily with such callers as CBS, ABC, NBC, every New York City paper, the London Daily Express, and numerous individuals. He and I had got no work at all accomplished. Then a television camera crew arrived and filled the room to tape an interview with Malcolm X by ABC's commentator, Bill Butel. As the crew was setting up its floodlights on tripods, a Dayton, Ohio radio station called, wishing to interview Malcolm X by telephone. He asked me to ask them to call him the following day at his sister Ella's home in Boston. Then the Ghana Ministry of Information called. I turned with a note to Malcolm X, to whom the commentator Butel had just said, "I won't take much of your time, I just have a few probably stupid questions." Glancing at my note, Malcolm X said to Butel, "Only the unasked question is stupid," and then to me, "Tell them I'll call them back, please." Then, just as the television cameras began rolling, with Butel and Malcolm X talking, the telephone rang again, and it was Life magazine reporter Mark Crawford to whom I whispered what was happening. Crawford, undaunted, asked if the open receiver could be placed where he could hear the interview, and I complied, relieved that it was one way to let the interview proceed without interruption. The manuscript copy which Malcolm X was given to review was in better shape now, and he pored through page by page, intently, and now and then his head would raise with some comment. "You know," he said once, "why I've been able to have some effect is because I make a study of the weaknesses of this country, and because the more the white man yelps, the more I know I have struck a nerve." Another time, he put down upon the bed the manuscript he was reading, and he got up from his chair and walked back and forth, stroking his chin. Then he looked at me. "You know, this place here in this chapter where I told you how I put the pistol up to my head and kept pulling the trigger and scared them so when I was starting the burglary ring, well..." He paused. I don't know if I ought to tell you this or not, but I want to tell the truth. He eyed me speculatively. I palmed the bullet. We laughed together. I said, okay, give that page here. I'll fix it. Then he considered, no, leave it that way. Too many people would be so quick to say that's what I'm doing today. Bluffing. Again, when reading about the period when he had discovered the prison library, Malcolm X's head jerked up. Boy, I never will forget that old aardvark. The next evening, he came into the room and told me that he'd been to the Museum of Natural History and learned something about the aardvark. Now, aardvark actually means earth hog. That's a good example of root words, as I was telling you. When you study the science of philology, you learn the laws governing how a consonant can lose its shape, but it keeps its identity from language to language. What astonished me here was that I knew on that day Malcolm X's schedule had been crushing, involving both a television and radio appearance and a live speech, yet he had gone to find out something about the aardvark. Before long, Malcolm X called a press conference and announced, "My new organization of Afro-American Unity is a non-religious and non-sectarian group organized to unite Afro-Americans for a constructive program toward attainment of human rights." The new OAAU's tone appeared to be one of militant black nationalism. He said to the questions of various reporters in subsequent interviews that the OAAU would seek to convert the Negro population from nonviolence to active self-defense against white supremacists across America. On the subject of politics, he offered an enigma. Whether you use bullets or ballots, you've got to aim well. Don't strike at the puppet. Strike at the puppeteer. Did he envision any special area of activity? I'm going to join in the fight wherever Negroes ask for my help. What about alliance with other Negro organizations? He said that he would consider forming some united front with certain selected Negro leaders. He conceded under questioning that the NAACP was doing some good. Could any whites join his OAAU? If John Brown were alive, maybe him. And he answered his critics with such statements as that he would send armed guerrillas into Mississippi. I am dead serious. We will send them not only to Mississippi, but to any place where black people's lives are threatened by white bigots. As far as I'm concerned, Mississippi is anywhere south of the Canadian border. At another time, when Evelyn Cunningham of the Pittsburgh Courier asked Malcolm X in a kidding way, "Say something startling for my column," he told her, "Anyone who wants to follow me and my movement has got to be ready to go to jail, to the hospital, and to the cemetery before he can be truly free." Evelyn Cunningham, printing the item, commented, "He smiled and chuckled, but he was in dead earnest." His fourth child, yet another daughter, was born, and he and Sister Betty named the baby Gamila Lumumba. A young waitress named Helen Lanier at Harlem's 22 Club, where Malcolm X now often asked people to meet him, gave him a layette for the new baby. He was very deeply touched by the gesture. "Why, I hardly know that girl." He was clearly irked when a New York Times poll among New York City Negroes reflected that 3/4 had named Dr. Martin Luther King as doing the best work for Negroes, and another 1/5 had voted for the NAACP's Roy Wilkins, while only 6% had voted for Malcolm X. "Brother," he said to me, "do you realize that some of history's greatest leaders never were recognized until they were safely in the ground?" One morning in midsummer 1964, Malcolm X telephoned me and said that he would be leaving within the next 2 or 3 days for a planned 6 weeks abroad. I heard from him first in Cairo, about as the predicted long hot summer began in earnest, with riots and other uprisings of Negroes occurring in suburban Philadelphia, in Rochester, in Brooklyn, in Harlem, and other cities. The New York Times reported that a meeting of Negro intellectuals had agreed that Dr. Martin Luther King could secure the allegiance of the middle and upper classes of Negroes, but Malcolm X alone could secure the allegiance of Negroes at the bottom. The Negroes respect Dr. King and Malcolm X because they sense in these men absolute integrity and know they will never sell them out. Malcolm X cannot be corrupted, and the Negroes know this, and therefore respect him. They also know that he comes from the lower depths, as they do, and regard him as one of their own. Malcolm X is going to play a formidable role because the racial struggle is now shifted to the urban North. If Dr. King is convinced that he has sacrificed 10 years of brilliant leadership, he will be forced to revise his concepts. There is only one direction in which he can move, and that is in the direction of Malcolm X. I sent a clipping of that story to Malcolm X in Cairo. In Washington, D.C., and New York City, at least, powerful civic, private, and governmental agencies and individuals were keenly interested in what Malcolm X was saying abroad and were speculating upon what would he say and possibly do when he returned to America. In upstate New York, I received a telephone call from a close friend who said he had been asked to ask me if I would come to New York City on an appointed day to meet with a very high government official who was interested in Malcolm X. I did fly down to the city. My friend accompanied me to the offices of a large private foundation well known for its activities and donations in the civil rights area. I met the foundation's president, and he introduced me to the Justice Department Civil Rights Section head, Burke Marshall. Marshall was chiefly interested in Malcolm X's finances, particularly how his extensive traveling since his black Muslim ouster had been paid for. I told him that, to the best of my knowledge, the several payments from the publisher had financed Malcolm X, along with fees he received for some speeches and possible donations that his organization received, and that Malcolm X had told me of borrowing money from his sister Ella for the current trip, and that recently the Saturday Evening Post had bought the condensation rights of the book for a substantial sum that was soon to be received. Marshall listened quietly, intently, and asked a few questions concerning other aspects of Malcolm X's life, then thanked me. I wrote to Malcolm X in Cairo that night about the interview. He never mentioned it. The Saturday Evening Post flew photographer John Lanois to Cairo to locate Malcolm X and photograph him in color. The magazine's September 12th issue appeared, and I sent a copy by airmail to Malcolm X. Within a few days, I received a stinging note expressing his anger at the magazine's editorial regarding his life story. The editorial's opening sentence read, "If Malcolm X were not a Negro, his autobiography would be little more than a journal of abnormal psychology, the story of a burglar, dope pusher, addict, and jailbird, with a family history of insanity, who acquires messianic delusions and sets forth to preach an upside-down religion of brotherly hatred." I wrote to Malcolm X that he could not fairly hold me responsible for what the magazine had written in a separate editorial opinion. He wrote an apology. "But the greatest care must be exercised in the future." His return from Africa was even more auspicious than when he'd returned from the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. A large group of Negroes, his followers and well-wishers, kept gathering in the overseas arrival building at Kennedy Airport. When I entered, white men with cameras were positioned on the second level, taking pictures of all the Negroes who entered, and almost as obvious were Negro plainclothesmen moving about. Malcolm's greeters had draped across the glass overlooking the U.S. Customs inspection line some large cloth banners on which were painted in bold letters, "Welcome Home, Malcolm." He came in sight, stepping into one of the customs inspection lines. He heard the cheering and he looked up, smiling his pleasure. Malcolm X wanted to huddle with me to fill me in on details from his trip that he wanted in the book. He said that he was giving me only the highlights because he felt that his carefully kept diary might be turned into another book. We had intensive sessions in my hotel room where we read what he selected from the diary and I took notes. "What I want to stress is that I was trying to internationalize our problem," he said to me, "to make the Africans feel their kinship with us Afro-Americans. I made them think about it, that they are our blood brothers and we all came from the same foreparents. That's why the Africans loved me, the same way the Asians loved me because I was religious." Within a few days, he had no more time to see me. He would call and apologize. He was beset by a host of problems, some of which he mentioned, and some of which I heard from other people. Most immediately, there was discontent within his organization, the OAAU. His having stayed away almost three times as long as he had said he would be gone had sorely tested the morale of even his key members, and there was a general feeling that his interest was insufficient to expect his followers' interest to stay high. I heard from one member that a growing disillusion could be sensed throughout the organization. In Harlem at large, in the bars and restaurants, on the street corners and stoops, there could be heard more blunt criticism of Malcolm X than ever before in his career. There were, variously expressed, two primary complaints. One was that actually Malcolm X only talked, but other civil rights organizations were doing. All he's ever done was talk. CORE and SNCC and some of them people of Dr. King's are out getting beat over the head. The second major complaint was that Malcolm X was himself too confused to be seriously followed any longer. He doesn't know what he believes in. No sooner do you hear one thing than he's switched to something else. The two complaints were not helping the old firebrand Malcolm X image any, nor were they generating the local public interest that was badly needed by his small, young OAAU. A court had made it clear that Malcolm X and his family would have to vacate the Elmhurst house for its return to the adjudged legal owners, Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam. And other immediate problems which Malcolm X faced included finances. Among his other expenses, a wife and four daughters had to be supported, along with at least one full-time OAAU official. Upon his return from Africa, our agent for the book had delivered to me for Malcolm X a check for a sizable sum. Soon afterward, Malcolm X told me, laughing wryly, "It's evaporated. I don't know where." Malcolm X plunged into a welter of activities. He wrote and telephoned dozens of acceptances to invitations to speak, predominantly at colleges and universities, both to expound his philosophies and to earn the $150 to $300 honorariums above traveling expenses. When he was in New York City, he spent all the time he could in his OAAU's sparsely furnished office on the mezzanine floor of the Hotel Teresa, trying to do something about the OAAU's knotty problems. "I'm not exposing our size and numbers," he evaded the query of one reporter. "You know, the strongest part of a tree is the root, and if you expose the root, the tree dies. Why, we have many invisible members of all types. Unlike other leaders, I practice the flexibility to put myself into contact with every kind of Negro in the country. Even at mealtimes, at his favorite 22 Club or elsewhere in Harlem, he could scarcely eat for the people who came up asking for appointments to discuss with him topics ranging from personal problems to his opinions on international issues. It seemed not in him to say no to such requests. And aides of his, volunteering their time, as often as not had to wait lengthy periods to get his ear for matters important to the OAAU or to himself. Often even then, he most uncharacteristically showed an impatience with their questions or their suggestions, and they chafed visibly. And at least once weekly, generally on Sunday evenings, he would address as many Negroes as word of mouth and mimeographed advertising could draw to hear him in Harlem's Audubon Ballroom on West 166th Street, between Broadway and St. Nicholas Avenue, near New York City's famous Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. Malcolm X, for some reason, suddenly began to deliver a spate of attacks against Elijah Muhammad, making more bitter accusations of religious fakery and immorality than he ever had. Very possibly, Malcolm X had grown increasingly incensed by the imminence of the court's deadline for him to have to move his wife and four little daughters from the comfortable home in which they had lived for years in Elmhurst. And Sister Betty was again pregnant. "A home is really the only thing I've ever provided, Betty, since we've been married," he had told me, discussing the court's order. "And they want to take that away. Man, I can't keep on putting her through changes. All she's put up with. Man, I've got to love this woman." A rash of death threats were anonymously telephoned to the police, to various newspapers, to the OAAU office, and to the family's home in Elmhurst. When he went to court again, fighting to keep the house, he was guarded by a phalanx of 8 OAAU men, 20 uniformed policemen, and 12 plainclothes detectives. The court's decision was that the order to vacate would not be altered. When Malcolm X reached home in Long Island, one of his followers, telephoning him there, got instead a telephone company operator who said that the OL16320 number was disconnected. A carload of his OAAU followers, racing to Long Island, found Malcolm X and his family perfectly safe. Inquiry of the telephone company revealed that a Mrs. Small had called and requested that the service for that number be disconnected for vacation. The OAAU followers drove back to Harlem. There was an ensuing confrontation between them and followers of Elijah Muhammad in front of the black Muslim restaurant at 116th Street and Lenox Avenue. The incident wound up with policemen who rushed to the scene finding two guns in the OAAU car, and the six OAAU men were arrested. Malcolm X had a date to speak in Boston, but he was too busy to go, and he sent an OAAU assistant who spoke instead. The car returning him to the Boston airport was blocked at the East Boston Tunnel by another car. Reportedly, men with knives rushed out of the blockade car, but the Malcolm X forces showed a shotgun, and the attackers dispersed. Malcolm X steadily accused the black Muslims as the source of the various attacks and threats. "There is no group in the United States more able to carry out this threat than the black Muslims," he said. "I know, because I taught them myself." Asked why he had attacked the black Muslims and Elijah Muhammad when things had seemed to be cooled down, he said, "I would not have revealed any of this if they had left me alone." He let himself be photographed in his home, holding an automatic carbine rifle with a full double clip of ammunition that he said he kept ready for action against any possible assassination efforts. "I've taught my wife to use it, and instructed her to fire on anyone, white, black, or yellow, who tries to force his way inside." I went to New York City in December for Malcolm X's reading of final additions to the manuscript to include the latest developments. He was further than I'd ever seen him from his old, assured self, it seemed to me. He kept saying that the press was making light of his statements about the threats on his life. "They act like I'm jiving." He brought up again the Saturday Evening Post editorial. "You can't trust the publishing people. I don't care what they tell you." The agent for the book sent to my hotel a contract dealing with foreign publication rights, which needed Malcolm X's and my signature. I signed it, as he observed, and handed the pen to him. He looked suspiciously at the contract and said, "I'd better show this thing to my lawyer," and put the contract in his inside coat pocket. Driving in Harlem about an hour later, he suddenly stopped the car across the street from the 135th Street YMCA building. Withdrawing the contract, he signed it and thrust it to me. "I'll trust you," he said, and drove on. With Christmas approaching, upon an impulse, I bought for Malcolm X's two oldest daughters two large dolls with painted brown complexions, the kind of dolls that would walk when held by the left hand. When Malcolm X next came to my room in the Hotel Wellington, I said, "I've gotten something for you to take to Attila and Kubila for Christmas gifts." And I walked out the dolls. Amazement, then a wide grin spread over his face. "Well, what do you know about that?" "Well, how about that?" He bent to examine the dolls. His expression showed how touched he was. "You know," he said after a while, "this isn't something I'm proud to say, but I don't think I've ever bought one gift for my children. Everything they play with, either Betty got it for them or somebody gave it to them. Never me. That's not good, I know it. I've always been too busy." In early January, I flew from upstate New York to Kennedy Airport, where I telephoned Malcolm X at home and told him that I was waiting for another plane to Kansas City to witness the swearing-in of my younger brother, George, who had recently been elected a Kansas State Senator. "Tell your brother for me to remember us in the alley," Malcolm X said. "Tell him that he and all of the other moderate Negroes who are getting somewhere need to always remember that it was us extremists who made it possible." He said that when I was ready to leave Kansas, to telephone him saying when I would arrive back in New York, and if he could, we could get together. I did this, and he met me at Kennedy Airport. He had only a little while. He was so pressed, he said. He had to leave that afternoon himself for a speaking engagement which had come up. So I made reservations for the next flight back upstate. Then we went outside and sat and talked in his car in a parking lot. He talked about the pressures on him everywhere he turned, and about the frustrations, among them that no one wanted to accept anything relating to him except my old hate and violence image. He said the so-called moderate civil rights organizations avoided him as too militant, and the so-called militants avoided him as too moderate. "They won't let me turn the corner," he once exclaimed. "I'm caught in a trap." In a happier area, we talked about the coming baby. We laughed about the four girls in a row already. "This one will be the boy," he said. He beamed. "If not, the next one." When I said it was close to time for my plane to leave, he said he had to be getting on, too. I said, "Give my best to Sister Betty." He said that he would. We shook hands, and I got outside and stood as he backed the blue Oldsmobile from its parking space. I called out, "See you," and we waved as he started driving away. There was no way to know that it was the last time I would see him alive. On January 19th, Malcolm X appeared on the Pierre Bertrand television show in Canada and said, in response to a question about integration and intermarriage, "I believe in recognizing every human being as a human being, neither white, black, brown, or red. And when you are dealing with humanity as a family, there's no question of integration or intermarriage. It's just one human being marrying another human being, or one human being living around and with another human being. I may say, though, that I don't think it should ever be put upon a black man. I don't think the burden to defend any position should ever be put upon the black man, because it is the white man collectively who has shown that he is hostile toward integration and toward intermarriage and toward these other strides toward oneness. So as a black man, and especially as a black American, any stand that I formally took, I don't think that I would have to defend it, because it's still a reaction to the society, and it's a reaction that was produced by the society. And I think that it is the society that produced this that should be attacked, not the reaction that develops among the people who are the victims of that negative society." From this, it would be fair to say that 1 month before his death, Malcolm had revised his views on intermarriage to the point where he regarded it as simply a personal matter. On the 28th of January, Malcolm X was on TWA's flight number 9 from New York that landed at about 3 p.m. in Los Angeles. A special police intelligence squad saw Malcolm X greeted by two close friends, Edward Bradley and Alan Jamal, who drove him to the Statler Hilton Hotel, where Malcolm X checked into room 1129. Said Bradley, "As we entered the lobby, six men came in right after us. I recognized them as black Muslims." When Malcolm X returned downstairs to the lobby, he practically bumped into the Muslim entourage. The Muslims were stunned. Malcolm's face froze, but he never broke his gait. Then we knew we were facing trouble. Malcolm X's friends drove him to pick up two former secretaries of Elijah Muhammad who had filed paternity suits against him. And they went to the office of the colorful Los Angeles attorney, Gladys Root. Mrs. Root said that Malcolm X made accusations about Elijah Muhammad's conduct with various former secretaries. After dinner, Malcolm X's two friends drove him back to the hotel. "Black Muslims were all over the place," Bradley related. "Some were in cars and others stood around near the hotel. They had the hotel completely surrounded. Malcolm sized up the situation and jumped out of the car. He warned me to watch out and ran into the lobby. He went to his room and remained there for the rest of his stay in Los Angeles." The car in which Malcolm X left the hotel, bound for the airport, was followed, said Bradley. "Hardly had we got on the freeway when we saw two carloads of black Muslims following us. The cars started to pull alongside. Malcolm picked up my walking cane and stuck it out of a back window as if it were a rifle. The two cars fell behind. We picked up speed, pulled off the airport ramp, and roared up to the front of the terminal. The police were waiting, and Malcolm was escorted to the plane through an underground passageway. Then I saw Malcolm to the plane." Chicago police were waiting when the plane landed at O'Hare Airport that night at 8 o'clock. Driven to the Bristol Hotel, Malcolm X checked in, and the adjoining suite was taken by members of the police force who would keep him under steady guard for the next 3 days in Chicago. Malcolm X testified at the office of the Attorney General of the state of Illinois, which had been investigating the Nation of Islam. Another day he appeared on the television program of Irv Kupcinet. He described attempts that had been made to kill him. He said he had on his desk a letter naming the persons assigned to kill him. When police returned Malcolm X to his hotel, at least 15 grim-faced Negroes were loitering nearby. Whispered Malcolm X to Detective Sergeant Edward McClellan, "Those are all black Muslims. At least two of them I recognize as being from New York. Elijah seems to know every move I make." Later, in his room, he told the detective, "It's only going to be a matter of time before they catch up with me. I know too much about the Muslims, but their threats are not going to stop me from what I'm determined to do." After that night spent in the hotel, Malcolm X was police escorted back to O'Hare, where he caught a plane to New York City's Kennedy Airport. Right away, he was served with a court order of eviction from the Elmhurst home. He telephoned me upstate. His voice was strained. He told me that he'd filed an appeal to the court order. that on the next day he was going to Alabama, and thence to England and France for scheduled speeches, and soon after returning he would go to Jackson, Mississippi, to address the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party on February 19th. Then he said, the first time he'd ever voiced to me such an admission, Haley, my nerves are shot, my brain's tired. He said that upon his return from Mississippi, he would like to come and spend 2 or 3 days in the town where I was and read the book's manuscript again. You say it's a quiet town. Just a couple of days of peace and quiet. That's what I need. I said that he knew he was welcome, but there was no need for him to tax himself reading through the long book again, as it had only a few very minor editing changes since he'd only recently read it. I just want to read it one more time, he said, because I don't expect to read it in finished form. So we made a tentative agreement that the day after his projected return from Mississippi, he would fly upstate to visit for a weekend with me. The projected date was the Saturday and Sunday of February 2021. Jet Magazine reported Malcolm X's trip to Selma, Alabama, on the invitation of 2 members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Dr. Martin Luther King was in a Selma jail when Malcolm X's arrival sent officials of Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference into a tailspin. Quickly, the SCLC's executive director, Reverend Andrew Young, and Reverend James Bevel met with Malcolm X, urging him not to incite any incidents and cautioning him that his presence could cause violence. He listened with a smile, said Miss Faye Bellamy, secretary of the SNCC, who accompanied Malcolm X to a Negro church where he would address a mass meeting. Remember this, nobody puts words in my mouth, he told Miss Bellamy. He told her that, in about 2 weeks, he planned to start Southern recruiting for his Harlem-based OAAU. At the church where he would speak, Malcolm X was seated on the platform next to Mrs. Martin Luther King, to whom he leaned and whispered that he was trying to help, she told Jet. He said he wanted to present an alternative, that it might be easier for whites to accept Martin's proposals after hearing him, Malcolm X. I didn't understand him at first, said Mrs. King. He seemed rather anxious to let Martin know he was not causing trouble or making it difficult, but that he was trying to make it easier. Later, in the hallway, he reiterated this. He seemed sincere. Addressing the mass meeting, Malcolm X reportedly shouted, I don't advocate violence, but if a man steps on my toes, I'll step on his. Whites better be glad Martin Luther King is rallying the people, because other forces are waiting to take over if he fails. Returned to New York City, Malcolm X soon flew to France. He was scheduled to speak before a Congress of African Students, but he was formally advised that he would not be permitted to speak, and moreover, that he could consider himself officially barred forever from France as an undesirable person. He was asked to leave, and he did, fuming with indignation. He flew on to London, and reporters of the British Broadcasting Corporation took him on an interviewing tour in Smethwick, a town near Birmingham with a large colored population. Numerous residents raised a storm of criticism that the BBC was a party to a fanning of racism in the already tension-filled community. On this visit, he spoke also at the London School of Economics. Malcolm X returned to New York City on Saturday, February 13th. He was asleep with his family when at about 3:15 the following Sunday morning, a terrifying blast awakened them. Sister Betty would tell me later that Malcolm X, barking commands and snatching up screaming, frightened children, got the family safely out of the back door into the yard. Someone had thrown flaming Molotov cocktail gasoline bombs through the front picture window. It took the fire department an hour to extinguish the flames. Half the house was destroyed. Malcolm X had no fire insurance. Pregnant, distraught Sister Betty and the 4 little daughters went to the home of close friends. Malcolm X steeled himself to catch a plane as scheduled that morning to speak in Detroit. He wore an open-necked sweater shirt under his suit. Immediately afterward, he flew back to New York. Monday morning, amid a flurry of emergency rehousing plans for his family, Malcolm X was outraged when he learned that Elijah Muhammad's New York Mosque No. 7 minister, James X., had told the press that Malcolm X himself had firebombed the home to get publicity. Monday night, Malcolm X spoke to an audience in the familiar Audubon Ballroom. If he had possessed the steel nerves not to become rattled in public before, now he was, I've reached the end of my rope," he shouted to the audience of 500. "I wouldn't care for myself if they would not harm my family," he declared flatly. "My house was bombed by the Muslims," and he hinted at revenge. "There are hunters. There are also those who hunt the hunters." Tuesday, February 16th, Malcolm X telephoned me. He spoke very briefly, saying that the complications following the bombing of his home had thrown his plans so awry that he would be unable to visit me upstate on the weekend, as he had said he would. He said he'd also had to cancel his planned trip to Jackson, Mississippi, which he was going to try and make later. He said he had to hurry to an appointment and hung up. I would read later where also on that day he told a close associate, "I have been marked for death in the next 5 days. I have the names of 5 black Muslims who have been chosen to kill me. I will announce them at the meeting." And Malcolm X told a friend that he was going to apply to the police department for a permit to carry a pistol. "I don't know whether they will let me have one or not, as I served time in prison." On Thursday, he told a reporter, in an interview which did not appear until after his death, "I'm man enough to tell you that I can't put my finger on exactly what my philosophy is now, but I'm flexible." The blackboard in the OAAU office counseled members and visitors that "Brother Malcolm speaks, Thursday, February 18th, WINS station, 10:30 p.m. Earlier Thursday, Malcolm X discussed locating another home with a real estate dealer. On Friday, he had an appointment with Gordon Parks, the Life magazine photographer-author whom he had long admired and respected. He appeared calm and somewhat resplendent with his goatee and Astrakhan hat, Parks would report later in Life. Much of the old hostility and bitterness seemed to have left him, but the fire and confidence were still there. Malcolm X, speaking of the old Mosque No. 7 days, said, "That was a bad scene, brother. The sickness and madness of those days, I'm glad to be free of them. It's a time for martyrs now. And if I'm to be one, it will be in the cause of brotherhood. That's the only thing that can save this country. I've learned it the hard way, but I've learned it." Parks asked Malcolm X if it was really true that killers were after him. "It's as true as we are standing here," Malcolm X said. "They've tried it twice in the last 2 weeks." Parks asked him about police protection, and Malcolm X laughed. "Brother, nobody can protect you from a Muslim but a Muslim, or someone trained in Muslim tactics. I know. I invented many of those tactics." Recalling the incident of the young white college girl who had come to the black Muslim restaurant and asked, "What can I do?" And he told her, "Nothing," and she left in tears, Malcolm X told Gordon Parks, "Well, I've lived to regret that incident. In many parts of the African continent, I saw white students helping black people. Something like this kills a lot of argument. I did many things as a Muslim that I'm sorry for now. I was a zombie then, like all Muslims. I was hypnotized, pointed in a certain direction, and told to march. Well, I guess a man's entitled to make a fool of himself if he's ready to pay the cost. It cost me 12 years. Saturday morning, he drove Sister Betty to see a real estate man. The house that the man then showed them, that Malcolm X particularly liked, in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood also on Long Island, required a $3,000 down payment. Sister Betty indicated her approval, too, and Malcolm X told the real estate man he thought they would take it. Driving Sister Betty back to the friend's home where she was staying with the children, they estimated that it would cost them about another $1,000 to make the move. He stayed until mid-afternoon with Sister Betty at the friend's home, talking. He told her that he realized that she had been under protracted great strain and that he was sorry about it. When he got his hat to leave, to drive into Manhattan, standing in the hallway, he told Sister Betty, "We'll all be together. I want my family with me. Family shouldn't be separated. I'll never make another long trip without you. We'll get somebody to keep the children. I'll never leave you so long again." "I couldn't help but just break out grinning," Sister Betty would later tell me. She figured that he must have stopped at a nearby drugstore to use the telephone booth when I later told her that Malcolm X had telephoned me upstate at about 3:30 that afternoon. For the first time in nearly 2 years, I did not recognize immediately that the voice on the other end of the phone belonged to Malcolm X. He sounded as if he'd had a heavy, deep cold. He told me that in the middle of the night, he and some friends had helped a moving company's men take out of the other house all of the family's furniture and other belongings salvageable after the firebombing, before a sheriff's eviction party would set the things out on the sidewalk. Betty and I have been looking at a house we want to buy. He tried to chuckle. You know nobody's going to rent. Not to me, these days. He said, all I've got is about $150, and that he needed a $3,000 down payment plus $1,000 moving costs. He asked if I thought the publisher would advance him $4,000 against the projected profits from the book. I said that when our agent's offices opened on Monday morning, I would telephone, and I knew that he would query the publisher to see if it couldn't be arranged. Then Monday night, I would call him back and let him know. He said that he and Sister Betty had decided that although they were going to pay for the house, to avoid possible trouble, they'd gotten the agreement of his sister Ella, who lived in Boston, to let the house be bought in her name. He said that he still owed $1,500 to his sister Ella, which she had loaned him to make one trip abroad. Eventually, they would change the house's title into Sister Betty's name, he said, or maybe into the name of their oldest daughter, Attila. He digressed on the dangers he faced. But you know, I'm going to tell you something, brother. The more I keep thinking about this thing, the things that have been happening lately, I'm not all that sure it's the Muslims. I know what they can do and what they can't. And they can't do some of the stuff recently going on. Now, I'm going to tell you, the more I keep thinking about what happened to me in France, I think I'm going to quit saying it's the Muslims. Then, it seemed to me such an odd, abrupt change of subject. You know, I'm glad I've been the first to establish official ties between Afro-Americans and our blood brothers in Africa. And saying goodbye, he hung up. After that telephone call, Malcolm X drove on into Manhattan and to the New York Hilton Hotel between 53rd and 54th Streets at Rockefeller Center. He checked the blue Oldsmobile into the hotel garage, and then, in the lobby, he checked himself in and was assigned a 12th floor room to which a bellman accompanied him. Soon some Negro men entered the giant hotel's busy lobby. They began asking various bellmen what room Malcolm X was in. The bellman, of course, never would answer that question concerning any guest, and considering that it was Malcolm X whom practically everyone who read New York City newspapers knew was receiving constant death threats, the bellman quickly notified the hotel's security chief. From then until Malcolm X checked out the next day, extra security vigilance was continuously maintained on the 12th floor. During that time, Malcolm X left the room only once to have dinner in the hotel's lobby-level, dimly-lit bourbon room. Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, Sister Betty in Long Island was surprised when her husband telephoned her and asked if she felt it would be too much trouble for her to get all of the four children dressed and bring them to the 2 o'clock meeting that afternoon at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. She said, of course it won't. On Saturday, he had told her that she couldn't come to the meeting. He said to her, you know what happened an hour ago? Exactly at 8 o'clock, the phone woke me up. Some man said, wake up, brother, and hung up. Malcolm X said goodbye to Sister Betty. And 4 hours later, Malcolm X left his room and took an elevator down to the lobby where he checked out. He got his car, and in the clear, warm midday of Sunday, February 21st, he drove uptown to the Audubon Ballroom. The Audubon Ballroom between Broadway and St. Nicholas Avenue on the south side of West 166th Street is a two-story building frequently rented for dances, organization functions, and other affairs. A dark, slender, pretty young lady, occupationally a receptionist, and avocationally a hard-working OAAU assistant to Malcolm X, has since told me that she arrived early, about 1:30 p.m., having some preliminary work to do. Entering, she saw that the usual 400 wooden chairs had been set up, with aisles on either side, but no center aisle. The young lady, she wishes to be nameless, noticed that several people were already seated in the front rows, but she gave it no thought since some always came early, liking to get seats up close to the stage to savor to the fullest the dramatic orator Malcolm X. On the stage, behind the speaker's stand, were 8 straight brown chairs arranged in a row, and behind him was the stage's painted backdrop, a mural of a restful country scene. The young lady's responsibilities for this day had included making arrangements and subsequent confirmations with the scheduled co-speaker, the Reverend Milton Galamison, the militant Brooklyn Presbyterian who in 1964 had led the 2 one-day Negro boycotts in New York City public schools protesting racial imbalance. She had similarly made arrangements with some other prominent Negroes who were due to appeal to the audience for their maximum possible contributions to aid the work of Malcolm X and his organization. The people who entered the ballroom were not searched at the door. In recent weeks, Malcolm X had become irritable about this, saying it makes people uncomfortable, and that it reminded him of Elijah Muhammad. "If I can't be safe among my own kind, where can I be?" he had once said testily. For this day also, he had ordered the press, as such, barred, white or black. He was angry at what he interpreted as slanted press treatment recently. He felt especially that the newspapers had not taken seriously his statements of the personal danger he was in. United Press International reporter Stanley Scott, a Negro, had been admitted, he later said, when a Malcolm lieutenant decided, "As a Negro, you will be allowed to enter as a citizen if you like, but you must remove your press badge." The same criterion had applied to WMCA newsman Hugh Simpson. Both he and Scott came early enough so that they obtained seats up near the stage. Malcolm X entered the ballroom at shortly before 2 o'clock, trudging heavily instead of with his usual lithe strides, his young lady assistant has told me. By this time, several other of his assistants were filtering in and out of the small anteroom alongside the stage. He sat down sideways on a chair, his long legs folded around its bottom, and he leaned one elbow on a kind of counter before a rather rickety makeup mirror that entertainers used when dances were held in the ballroom. He wore a dark suit, white shirt, and narrow dark tie. He said to a little group of his assistants that he wasn't going to talk about his personal troubles. "I don't want that to be the reason for anyone to come to hear me." He stood up and paced about the little room. He said he was going to state that he'd been hasty to accuse the black Muslims of bombing his home. "Things have happened since that are bigger than what they can do. I know what they can do. Things have gone beyond that." Those in the anteroom could hear the sounds of the enlarging audience outside taking seats. "The way I feel, I ought not to go out there at all today," Malcolm X said. "In fact, I'm going to ease some of this tension by telling the black man not to fight himself. That's all a part of the white man's big maneuver, to keep us fighting among ourselves, against each other. I'm not fighting anyone. That's not what we're here for." He kept glancing at his wristwatch, anticipating the arrival of Reverend Galamerson. "Whenever you make any appointment with a minister," he said to his young lady assistant, "you have to call them 2 or 3 hours before time, because they will change their mind. This is typical of ministers." "I felt bad. I felt that it was my fault," the young lady told me. "It was time for the meeting to start, too." She turned to Malcolm X's stalwart assistant, Benjamin X, known as a highly able speaker himself. "Brother, will you speak?" she asked. Then turning to Malcolm X, "Is it all right if he speaks? And maybe he can introduce you." Malcolm X abruptly whirled on her and barked, "You know you shouldn't ask me right in front of him." Then, collecting himself quickly, he said, "Okay. Brother Benjamin X asked how long he should speak." Malcolm X said, glancing again at his wristwatch, "Make it half an hour." And Brother Benjamin X went through the door leading onto the stage. They heard him expertly exhorting the audience about what is needed today by the black man here in these United States. The Reverend Galamerson and other notables due hadn't arrived by 3 o'clock. "Brother Malcolm looked so disappointed," the young lady says. "He said to me, 'I don't think any of them are coming either.' I felt so terrible for him. It did seem as if no one cared. I told him, 'Oh, don't worry, they're just late. They'll be here.'" It was also reported by another source that Galamerson, unable to come to the meeting, did telephone earlier, and that Malcolm X was told of this before he went out to speak. Then Brother Benjamin X's half hour was up, and the young lady and Malcolm X, alone back there in the anteroom, could hear him entering the introduction. "And now, without further remarks, I present to you one who is willing to put himself on the line for you, a man who would give his life for you. I want you to hear, listen, to understand, one who is a Trojan for the black man." Applause rose from the audience. At the anteroom door, Malcolm X turned and looked back at his young lady assistant. "You'll have to forgive me for raising my voice to you. I'm just about at my wit's end." "Oh, don't mention it," she said quickly. "I understand." His voice sounded far away. "I wonder if anybody really understands." And he walked out onto the stage, into the applause, smiling and nodding at Brother Benjamin X, who passed him en route to the anteroom. The young lady picked up some paperwork she had to do when Benjamin X came in, perspiring. She patted his hand, saying, "That was good." Through the anteroom door, just ajar, she and Benjamin X heard the applause diminishing. Then the familiar ringing greeting, "Assalamualaikum, brothers and sisters." "Assalamualaikum salam," some in the audience responded. About 8 rows of seats from the front, then, a disturbance occurred. In a sudden scuffling, a man's voice was raised angrily, "Take your hand out of my pocket." The entire audience was swiveling to look. "Hold it, hold it, don't get excited," Malcolm X said crisply. "Let's cool it, brothers." With his own attention distracted, it is possible that he never saw the gunmen. One woman who was seated near the front says, "The commotion back there diverted me just for an instant. Then I turned back to look at Malcolm X just in time to see at least 3 men in the front row stand and take aim and start firing simultaneously. It looked like a firing squad." Numerous persons later said they saw 2 men rushing toward the stage, one with a shotgun, the other with 2 revolvers. Said UPI reporter Stanley Scott, "Shots rang out. Men, women, and children ran for cover. They stretched out on the floor and ducked under tables." Radio station WMCA reporter Hugh Simpson said, "Then I heard this muffled sound. I saw Malcolm hit with his hand still raised. Then he fell back over the chairs behind him. Everybody was shouting. I saw one man firing a gun from under his coat behind me as I hit it. The floor, too. He was firing like he was in some western, running backward toward the door and firing at the same time." The young lady who was in the backstage anteroom told me, "It sounded like an army had taken over. Somehow I knew. I wouldn't go and look. I wanted to remember him as he was." Malcolm X's hand flew to his chest as the first of 16 shotgun pellets or revolver slugs hit him. Then the other hand flew up. The middle finger of the left hand was bullet-shattered, and blood gushed from his goatee. He clutched his chest. His big body suddenly fell back stiffly, knocking over 2 chairs. His head struck the stage floor with a thud. In the bedlam of shouting, screaming, running people, some ran toward the stage. Among them, Sister Betty scrambled up from where she'd thrown her body over her children, who were shrieking. She ran, crying hysterically, "My husband, they're killing my husband." An unidentified photographer snapped shots of Malcolm X, prone on the stage floor, with people bent over him, snatching apart his bloody shirt, loosening his tie, trying to give him mouth-to-mouth artificial respiration. First a woman, then a man. Said the woman, who identified herself only as a registered nurse, "I don't know how I got up on the stage, but I threw myself down on who I thought was Malcolm, but it wasn't. I was willing to die for the man. I would have taken the bullets myself. Then I saw Malcolm, and the firing had stopped, and I tried to give him artificial respiration." Then Sister Betty came through the people, herself a nurse, and people recognizing her moved back. She fell on her knees, looking down at his bare, bullet-pocked chest, sobbing, "They killed him." Patrolman Thomas Hoy, 22, was stationed outside the Audubon Ballroom entrance. "I heard the shooting and the place exploded." He rushed inside. He saw Malcolm X lying on the stage and then some people chasing a man. Patrolman Hoy grabbed the suspect. Louis Michaud, the owner of the Nationalist Memorial Bookstore at 125th Street and 7th Avenue in Harlem, said, "I was arriving late at the meeting where Malcolm X had invited me. I met a large number of people rushing out. Sergeant Alvin Aronoff and Patrolman Louis Angelos happened to be cruising by in their radio car when they heard shots. When we got there," said Aronoff, "the crowds were pushing out and screaming, 'Malcolm's been shot, and get him, don't let him go.' The 2 policemen grabbed by the arms a Negro who was being kicked as he tried to escape. Firing a warning shot into the air, the policemen pushed the man into their police car, not wanting the angry crowd to close in, and drove him quickly to the police station. Someone had run up to the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital's Vanderbilt Clinic emergency entrance at 167th Street and grabbed a poles and canvas stretcher and brought it back to the Audubon Ballroom stage. Malcolm X was put on the stretcher, and an unidentified photographer got a macabre picture of him with his mouth open and his teeth bared as men rushed him up to the hospital clinic emergency entrance. A hospital spokesman said later that it was about 3:15 p.m. when Malcolm X reached a third-floor operating room. He was either dead or in a death-appearing state, said the spokesman. A team of surgeons cut through his chest to attempt to massage the heart. The effort was abandoned at 3:30 p.m. Reporters who had descended upon the hospital office fired questions at the spokesman, who kept saying brusquely, "I don't know." Then he took the elevator upstairs to the emergency operating room. A small crowd of friends and Sister Betty had also pushed into the hospital office when the hospital spokesman returned. Collecting himself, he made an announcement. The gentleman you know as Malcolm X is dead. He died from gunshot wounds. He was apparently dead before he got here. He was shot in the chest several times, and once in the cheek. The group filed out of the hospital office. The Negro men were visibly fighting their emotions. One kept smashing his fist into the other cupped palm. Among the women, many were openly crying. Moments after the news flashed throughout Harlem, and throughout the entire world, a crowd began to gather outside the Hotel Teresa, where Malcolm X's OAAU had its headquarters. They learned over transistor radios that the man whom the two policemen had taken from the murder scene initially identified himself as Thomas Hagen, 22. He was later identified as Talmage Hayer. In his right trousers pocket, the policeman had found a .45 caliber cartridge clip containing four unused cartridges. And then at Jewish Memorial Hospital, doctors had reported that Hayer had been shot in the left thigh. His forehead was bruised, and his body was beaten. If we hadn't gotten him away, they would have kicked him to death, Sergeant Aronoff had said, and Hayer had been taken to the Bellevue Hospital prison ward. By 5 p.m., the crowd in front of the Teresa Hotel had been quietly, carefully dispersed, and the Black Muslim Mosque No. 7 and its restaurant around the corner at 116th Street and Lenox Avenue had been ordered closed as a precautionary measure, on the orders of the local 28th Precinct's Captain Lloyd Seeley, New York City's first Negro to command a precinct. When reporters telephoned the Black Muslim restaurant, a man's voice stated, "No one is available to make any statement." When the OAAU office in the Teresa Hotel was tried, the telephone kept ringing, unanswered. Precinct Captain Seeley soon appeared, walking by himself along 125th Street, swinging his nightstick and conversing with people he met. At the 28th Precinct Station House on West 123rd Street, the 40 policemen who were to have gone off duty at 4 p.m. had been told they must remain on duty, and two full busloads of the highly trained New York City Police Tactical Patrol Force had arrived at the precinct. Various high police officials made press statements. A Tactical Patrol Force captain, Harry Kaiser, said no unusual occurrences had been noted, and he anticipated no trouble. Deputy Police Commissioner Walter Arm said that hundreds of extra policemen would be put into the Harlem area, including some members of the Bureau of Special Services. An assistant chief inspector, Harry Taylor, speculated that the assassins had not rushed from the ballroom among the crowd, but had kept running past the stage and escaped on 165th Street. In the early evening, the police department's chief of detectives, Philip J. Walsh, quit a vacation he was on to join the hunt for the killers, and he said he looked forward to a long, drawn-out investigation. Police and reporters at the shooting scene had pictures taken of the stage, with white chalk marks now circling five bullet holes in the speaker's stand. There were other holes in the stage's mural backdrop, indicating slugs or shotgun pellets which had either missed Malcolm X or passed through him. Police declined to discuss a rumor sweeping Harlem that they had some motion pictures which had been taken in the Audubon Ballroom as the murder took place. Another rumor that gained swift momentum was that when Sister Betty had leaned over her husband's body, she had removed from his coat pocket a paper on which he had written the names of those he had supposedly learned were assigned to execute him. Deputy Police Commissioner Walter Arm stressed that the department had made efforts to protect Malcolm X. 20 different times the department had offered protection to Malcolm X or to some of his assistants, and the protection was refused, said Commissioner Arm. And 17 times uniformed police guards had been offered for the OAAU meetings at the Audubon Ballroom, the most recent time being last Sunday. Asked about the pistol permit that Malcolm X had said publicly he planned to request, Commissioner Arm said that as far as he knew, Malcolm X had never actually filed a request. A number of questions have been raised. The suspect, arrested by Patrolman Hoy as he was being chased from the meeting, has, at present writing, not been identified publicly. Deputy Police Commissioner Walter Arm's statement that Malcolm X refused police protection conflicts directly with the statements of many of his associates that during the week preceding his assassination, Malcolm X complained repeatedly that the police would not take his requests for protection seriously. Finally, although police sources said that a special detail of 20 men had been assigned to the meeting, and that it had even been attended by agents of the Bureau of Special Services, these men were nowhere in evidence during or after the assassination, and Talmage Hayer, rescued from the crowd and arrested as a suspect immediately after the assassination, was picked up by two patrolmen in a squad car cruising by. On long-distance telephones, reporters reached the Chicago mansion headquarters of Elijah Muhammad. He would not come to the telephone, but a spokesman of his said that Muhammad has no comment today, but he might have something to say tomorrow. No statement could be obtained either from Malcolm X's oldest brother, Wilfred X, the black Muslim minister of Mosque No. 1 in Detroit. At his home, a woman told reporters that Minister Wilfred X was not there, that he had not gone to New York, and she didn't believe he had any plans to do so. Minister Wilfred X reached later, said that he anticipated attending the black Muslim convention in Chicago on the following Sunday, and regarding his brother, my brother is dead and there is nothing we can do to bring him back. As dark fell, many Negro men and women assembled before Louis Michaud's bookstore, where most of Harlem's black nationalist public activity centered. A small group of OAAU members opened their Hotel Teresa headquarters and sat in the room and would not make any statements to reporters. The New York Daily News came onto the newsstands with its cover page devoted to Malcolm X Murdered, over the photograph of him being borne away on the stretcher, and a subcaption, Gunned Down at Rally. In Long Island, where she had been taken just after her father's murder, 6-year-old Attila carefully wrote a letter to him. Dear Daddy, I love you so. Oh dear, I wish you wasn't dead. The body, still listed as John Doe because it had not yet been formally identified, had been moved late Sunday to the New York City Medical Examiner's office at 520 First Avenue. The autopsy confirmed that shotgun pellet wounds in the heart had killed Malcolm X. Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Milton Halpin said the death followed the first sawed-off shotgun blast, which caused 13 wounds in the heart and chest, and he said the 38 and 45 caliber bullet wounds in the thighs and legs evidenced that Malcolm X had been shot at after he had fallen. Monday morning, the official identification was made at the medical examiner's office by Sister Betty, who was accompanied by Percy Sutton, Malcolm X's Boston half-sister, Mrs. Ella Collins, and Joseph E. Hall, general manager of the large Unity Funeral Home in Harlem. Leaving the medical examiner's office at about noon to go and complete funeral arrangements, Sister Betty told reporters, "No one believed what he said. They never took him seriously. Even after the bombing of our home, they said he did it himself." At the Unity Funeral Home on the east side of 8th Avenue between 126th and 127th Streets, Sister Betty chose a 6-foot-9-inch bronze casket lined with eggshell velvet. At her request, the funeral would be delayed until the following Saturday, 5 days away. The funeral home's manager, Hall, announced to the press that the body would be dressed in a business suit and it would be put on view under a glass shield from Tuesday through Friday. Then the Saturday services would be at a Harlem church. Soon posted on the funeral home's directory was El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. In Brooklyn, Orthodox Muslim Sheikh Al-Hajj Daoud Ahmed Faisal of the Islamic Mission of America said that the delayed funeral services violated a Muslim practice that the sun should not set twice on a believer's body, that the Quran prescribed burial inside 24 hours if possible, and Muslims believed that when a body grows cold, the soul leaves it, and when the body is put into the earth, it comes alive again. In Chicago, where policemen were watching all bus depots, railways, terminals, O'Hare Airport and highway entrances, Elijah Muhammad, under heavy guard in his 3-story mansion, said, "Malcolm died according to his preaching. He seems to have taken weapons as his guard. Therefore, we couldn't tolerate a man like that. He preached war. We preach peace. We are permitted to fight if we are attacked. That's the scripture, the Quran, and the Bible, too. But we will never be the aggressor. I don't have the right to be frightened because I was chosen by Allah. If Allah gives me up to the hands of the wicked, I am satisfied. My life is in the hands of Allah." The grounds outside the mansion were patrolled by both Chicago police and Fruit of Islam bodyguards. More of both patrolled before the University of Islam High School and the offices of the newspaper Muhammad Speaks. Malcolm X's lawyer, Assemblyman Percy Sutton, said that the police now had the names of those who Malcolm X had said planned to kill him. All over Harlem, reporters were interviewing people, and microphones were being put before the mouths of the man in the street. At police precinct station houses, people being questioned were leaving by side entrances. Said Assistant Chief Inspector Joseph Coyle, in charge of Manhattan North detectives, "A well-planned conspiracy. We're doing a screening process of the 400 people who were in the hall at the time. 50 detectives were on the case," he said, and he'd been in touch with police in other cities. Harlem was mostly asleep when around the Black Muslim Mosque No. 7 on the top floor of a four-story building at 116th Street and Lenox Avenue, an explosive sound at 2:15 p.m. ripped the night. Firemen were instantly summoned by the four policemen who had been guarding the sidewalk entrance to the mosque. Within a few minutes, flames burst through the building's roof and leaped 30 feet into the air. For the next 7 hours, firemen would pour water into the building. On an adjacent roof, they found an empty 5-gallon gasoline can, a brown gasoline-stained shopping bag, and oily rags. Southbound IRT subway service was rerouted for a while, also 3 bus lines. At the spectacular 5-alarm fire's height, a wall of the building collapsed. It smashed 2 fire engines at the curb and injured 5 firemen, one seriously, and also a pedestrian who had been across the street buying a newspaper. By daybreak, when the fire was declared under control, the Black Muslim Mosque and the Gethsemane Church of God in Christ on the floor beneath it were gutted, and 7 street-level stores, including the Black Muslim restaurant, were total losses. Fire department sources said that replacing the ruined equipment would cost around $50,000. Joseph X of the Black Muslims, who once had been the immediate assistant of Malcolm X, said that Elijah Muhammad's followers had 2 alternative mosques to meet in, one in Brooklyn and the other in Queens, Long Island. Both these mosques were under continuous police guard. Across the nation, in San Francisco, on Tuesday afternoon, 2 policemen discovered a fire beginning in the San Francisco Black Muslim Mosque and quickly extinguished it. Kerosene had been splashed on the sidewalk and door and set afire. The body of El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz originally had been scheduled to go on public view at 2:30 p.m. Tuesday. Crowds stood in line behind police barricades waiting to be admitted, and the policemen, wherever one looked, included numerous patrol cars and even sharpshooters on the roofs around the Unity Funeral Home. But the telephoned bomb threats, which had begun shortly after noon, made necessary 2 evacuations of the funeral home for bomb squad searches, which proved futile. A search was conducted even in the 43rd Street offices of the New York Times after a man telephoned complaining of an editorial about Malcolm X and said, "Your plant will be destroyed at 4 o'clock. At the funeral home in Harlem, policemen inspected all packages and floral pieces being delivered, as well as the large handbags of women mourners. It was 6:15 p.m. when a cordon of policemen arrived, flanking Sister Betty and 4 close relatives and friends who entered the funeral home in a glare of flashbulbs. "She's a black Jacqueline Kennedy," observed a white reporter. "She has class. She knows what to do and when. She handles herself beautifully." It was 7:10 p.m. when the family party emerged and left. After 10 minutes, the first of the waiting public was admitted. Between then and an hour before midnight, 2,000 people, including scores of whites, had filed past the open coffin in which the body lay, dressed in a dark business suit, a white shirt and dark tie, with a small oblong brass plate above it inscribed, "El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, May 19, 1925, February 21, 1965. Malcolm X followers had been canvassing with growing anxiety for a Harlem church that would accept the Saturday funeral. Officials of several churches had refused, including a spokesman for the community's largest church, Abyssinian Baptist, of which Congressman Reverend Adam Clayton Powell is the pastor. Others which turned down requests, according to the Amsterdam News, included the Williams CME Church and the Refuge Temple of the Church of Our Lord Jesus Christ. Then the funeral was accepted by Bishop Alvin A. Childs for the Faith Temple, Church of God in Christ, located at 147th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. The Faith Temple, a former movie theater which had been converted 15 years previously, could seat 1,000 in its auditorium and another 700 in its basement. Bishop Childs, who in 1964 had been elected as Harlem's locality mayor, told the press that it was as a humanitarian gesture that he made his church available, and of Malcolm X he said, "A militant and vocal person. I did not agree with all of his philosophy, but this did not affect our friendship." Shortly after the news became known, Bishop Childs and his wife began to receive the first of a succession of bomb threats telephoned both to the church and to their home. Prominent Negro figures were being quoted by the various press media. The famed psychologist Dr. Kenneth B. Clark told Jet magazine, "I had a deep respect for this man. I believe that he was sincerely groping to find a place in the fight for civil rights, on a level where he would be respected and understood fully. I looked forward to his growth along those lines. It doesn't matter so much about his past. It is tragic that he was cut down at the point when he seemed on the verge of achieving the position of respectability he sought." A New York Times correspondent in a London press conference quoted the author and dramatist James Baldwin, who thought the death of Malcolm X was a major setback for the Negro movement. Pointing at white reporters, Baldwin accused, "You did it. Whoever did it was formed in the crucible of the Western world, of the American Republic. European rape of Africa began racial problems and was therefore the beginning of the end for Malcolm X," Baldwin said. The bookstore owner in Harlem, Louis Michaud, a major voice in the community, told the Amsterdam News, "It's things like the murder of Malcolm X that drive the masses closer together. He died in the same manner that Patrice Lumumba met his death in the Congo. We must unite, not fight." "Malcolm X caused many young Negroes to take a new vision of themselves," said Bayard Rustin, a main figure in organizing the March on Washington in 1963. A third party was suspected of killing Malcolm X by CORE's national director, James Farmer, who said, "Malcolm's murder was calculated to produce more violence and murder and vengeance killings." A few days later, asked for his opinion of a rumor circulating about that a red Chinese plot brought about the murder, Farmer said, "I would not say it is impossible. For the Negroes in America, the death of Malcolm X is the most portentous event since the deportation of Marcus Garvey in the 1920s, said Dr. C. Eric Lincoln, author of The Black Muslims in America, who talked to the press at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was a visiting professor and research fellow. "I doubt there are international implications in the slaying. The answer is closer to home. The answer is in the local struggle among contending rivals for leadership of the black masses, which are potentially the most volatile subgroup in America," said Roy Wilkins, executive secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. "Master spellbinder that he was, Malcolm X, in death, cast a spell more far-flung and more disturbing than any he cast in life." The New York City police investigators who were pursuing the case were unhappy that Malcolm's followers had not come forward to aid the investigation. At police request, the press printed a telephone number, SW58117, for "strictly confidential" information that anyone might offer concerning the slaying. The police had picked up and were holding Reuben Francis, described as a Malcolm X bodyguard, who was believed to be the person who had shot the suspected assassin, Talmadge Hayer, during the melee the previous Sunday at the Audubon Ballroom. Hayer remained in the Bellevue prison ward, awaiting surgery. As thousands continued viewing the body of the slain Malcolm X amid intermittent new bomb threats telephoned to the funeral home and to the Faith Temple where his funeral was scheduled for Saturday, a new organization, the Federation of Independent Political Action, threatened to picket all Harlem business establishments, which would not close from Thursday afternoon until Monday morning, in tribute to Malcolm X. The FIPA's spokesman was Jesse Gray, the well-known rent strike leader. Harlem pedestrians began to be handed printed sheets reading, in part, "If the stores refuse to close, they identify with our enemy. Therefore, we must close them. Pass them by. Those that shop along 125th Street during the hours that the stores are to be closed identify with the murderous stooge that allowed the power structure to use his hands to kill Brother Malcolm." At a late evening FIPA rally before Louis Michaud's bookstore, Jesse Gray declared that in 1965 a Negro should run for mayor of New York in the name of Malcolm, and speculated that such a candidate should receive 100,000 votes. Shortly after the FIPA rally, merchants and other members of the Uptown Chamber of Commerce met and swiftly passed a resolution urging all Harlem stores to remain open and continue to serve their customers. And recommendation was made that full pay be given to any store employees who might wish to attend Malcolm X's funeral on Saturday morning. Then, one after another, Harlem leaders sharply criticized the FIPA proposal as irresponsible. Finally, nearly all of the Harlem stores kept their doors open for business. The FIPA got together about 20 pickets who patrolled for a while before Harlem's largest store, Blumstein's. Leading the pickets were two white men carrying signs reading, "All stores should close. Honor Malcolm X." End of side 12.